Hello and welcome to the AIPT Comics Podcast. I'm your host, David Brook, and I'm here with the second host, Nathan Simmons.
I am the second host. That sounds biblical.
Well, if you were to intro the show,
yeah.
I would be the second host.
I guess, just because you're talking.
Is that how it works?
Is that, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah, totally.
Sure. How's it going?
How are you doing? I'm good. Good. I'm good.
Good.
I'm ready for the summer.
Yeah. Yeah, summer starts officially in like, what, 10 days, 11 days?
Is it? I always forget.
It's the 21st of June, maybe?
It's usually like an arbitrary thing, right? Like, summer, you feel summer before it actually is summer.
Yeah,
or
man,
sometimes it's
I
later.
Like that.
It was super hot this week in Boston.
Yeah, you know, it was murder. Today I went out and went to record store day at my local shop, and it was like so humid outside. I got there at like 7 in the morning, stood out, waited for them to open.
That was the mountains of Florida, right?
In the mountains of Florida, that's right. Yeah, it was worth it though. I got a good haul, and I'm feeling pretty good. So,
what's your top pick?
Off good. Okay, so for listeners who don't know, Record Store Day is a yearly tradition. Last year, it got broken up because of COVID, but it basically labels will reissue or press stuff to vinyl for the first time to bring people in and support indie record shops. So I got Prince's acoustic album was pressed to vinyl for the first time, and I was really
wow.
excited to find that.
Yeah.
And then I also got this, Cole Porter tribute album that's, came out back in like 1990. It was actually the first major label AIDS benefit release.
Huh.
So, it was really cool that they repressed that this year, and it's got all these different artists reinterpreting Cole Porter songs. So like,
nice.
Iggy Pop and Debbie Harry do a duet together, which is a trip. And, yeah, it's really great. It's got Tom Waits, Katie Lang, like the track list is like all over the place.
I've always wanted to get into vinyl. I love the idea. I love the feel of
sure.
it. I love the size. I just have never been a super music guy.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah.
I tend to trade like one collecting vice for another. So like for a while I was buying a ton of action figures, and now it's records and I mean comics
right.
never really went away for me. So records and comics are the things that like I have specifically stacking up at the house.
It is funny how like just owning a thing like makes you, I don't know, makes you part of it, right?
Oh yeah, no, there's definitely like a high that I get from like collecting stuff. Like I think we've talked about this on the show before. I've severely pruned down my Blu-ray collection to focus only on like collector's editions and all of the DC animated movies, but there's just something that like makes me happy to sit in my living room and just see I have a shelf that is just all the DC animated movies, and it makes me really
yeah.
happy that they're all up there in order.
If you ever needed to, you could pop one in and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Catch up with an old friend.
HBO Max, and they're mostly on there, but I'm just like, sometimes I just like I have the steelbook of Justice League Dark, and that makes me happy.
Right. You know, one time, I'm not even an Iggy Pop fan, but when I was, I took a trip to China like 7 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and in one of the airports, I forget which one, there was someone on one of those carts being driven to a gate. And I'm like, I did a double take and I'm like, my God, that's a rock star. And he's just like, you know, his pores are exuding rock star just by him sitting there with his legs crossed on the back of one of those little golf cart type things. Just like
no
waiting.
No shirt and a vest.
That's the funny thing. Like, I was like, why is his shirt on? He shouldn't have that on. That's not
so,
Iggy Pop.
That was so funny. And if you're going to see Iggy Pop anywhere, see him in China because he wrote China Girl.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I can't remember if it was in China or not, but yeah, it might have been on the way
that's
there.
That's amazing.
No, yeah, music is really important, and so are comics.
Yeah,
and
for
that's
sure.
That's why you're listening to the AIPT Comics Podcast, where we recap the biggest news of the week, we review our favorite comics, and we have guests on, too. Dan Fogler's on later in the show. He's the actor from Fantastic Beasts, but he's also a writer at Heavy Metal Magazine. He's got a couple books on the way, continued series like Fishkill and Moonlake. We'll be talking about his time at Heavy Metal, his focus on writing comics,
mm-hmm.
working with different creators like Ben Templesmith and Simon Beasley, et cetera, et cetera. So hang on for that. That's later in the show.
Yeah.
But to start, we're going to recap the biggest news of the week. And I think this might be the top news of the week because it's been so long since we've seen a Doctor Strange comic book.
Yeah.
So last week, Marvel teased Death of Doctor Strange is coming. Well, we just found out on Monday that Death of Doctor Strange number one is coming out in September. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, a writer that gets all the work now, Jed McKay, is going to be writing the series with Lee Garbett on art. So they detailed some of the story and gave us kind of a heads up, but mm-hmm. it's really cool to see Doctor Strange getting his own main series. I wonder, do you suppose this will be part of the legacy numbering for Doctor Strange?
I'm interested because the solicit almost makes it seem like it could even be its own continuity.
Right.
So I'm really curious to see, like, because this also, like, the way they describe it is a 5-issue epic that will tell the final chapter in the life of Doctor Strange, and mm-hmm. that smacks of, like, one of the Marvel The End series to me. So it's a really cool concept, and I just don't know exactly still what this is.
No, you're right. I'm a big fan of Lee Garbett. He did a great run on Lucifer at Vertigo.
Oh, sure.
Jeez, now like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think he's going to do a really good job on this just because of that whole metaphysical alternate dimension stuff. Obviously, this is probably coming because the Doctor Strange movie is coming next year, mm-hmm. right? Probably. That's usually how Marvel works.
It's interesting, though, because it also sounds like it's going to be almost a murder mystery, because, like, the question is, like, who killed Doctor Strange? So, like, mm-hmm. are we going to jump back and forth with people trying to figure out how this happened? Or, you know, it's really neat. I'm hoping it's something similar to, like, Daredevil The End, which I really... End of Days, which I thought was really cool.
Oh,
mm-hmm. This is really neat. It was funny, because last week... right before we started recording was when Marvel just released the title, and we were like, we got to talk about it. There was nothing to talk about.
No, now there is, but we're like, we'll see.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds really cool. It's a good creative team. So, and like you said, it's always good to see a new Doctor Strange book on the shelf.
For sure. We'll also be seeing new Spawn books on the shelf in our next bit of news.
No kidding.
Spawn Universe, yet to be released. Mm-hmm. It's coming out June 23rd. Has, according to Image Comics, already sold over 200,000 units. Holy crap, that's a lot of comics.
Yeah.
So I remember, gosh, like 6 months ago mm-hmm. now, Image announced that the Department of Truth sold over 100,000.
Yeah.
And everyone, I mean, folks like Tim Seeley and other creators were like, holy shit, that's a lot.
Yeah.
This is even more.
Image is crushing. Yeah, for
they
sure.
They are.
Spawn Boy Summer.
Spawn Boy Summer. I would love a Spawn Boy Summer. although we haven't yet seen these books, so who knows if they're actually good. But it is Todd McFarlane's big push to start a shared universe between multiple books and mm-hmm. characters and creators. So it's interesting to me this is happening now. I mean, we talked about this weeks ago when this Spawn universe was announced.
Yeah.
But like, why haven't they tried this before? Why was it always just one solo Spawn book?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, there's always been, like, little mini-series and, like, spinoffs here and there. But, yeah, they've never done, like, a concentrated push for it to be, like, essentially its own line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, clearly, the fans want it. They want a line of Spawn comics, and they're already voting with their wallets.
And honestly, like, in the last, like, month or so, how many times have we, like, just... fawned over the artwork coming out of these announcements too. Like there's some really cool stuff on the way.
You know, what's funny though, is I keep trying to read Spawn and I just can't get into it. It's so wordy and verbose and
sure.
There's so much heavy continuity. So I think this is a very smart move on Todd's
part. Oh yeah. It's so hard to jump into the main title now.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, yeah, it's just inaccessible mm-hmm. to the casual reader. So I am very curious to read these books and see how they pull them off.
Yeah.
And in other Todd McFarlane news, mm-hmm. Todd McFarlane is partnering with Whip for a new Sam and Twitch TV show series. Now, Sam and Twitch has been in the news to become a TV series for, it feels like a decade or more.
Right.
I believe Kevin Smith just a few years ago was supposed to be headlining this series, and obviously that never got off the ground.
Yeah, and I think at one point there was an animated series possibly in the works. Mm. Like, there's been a bunch of stuff over the years where they've started and stopped. I mean, it's very much like the Spawn sequel or reboot that McFarlane's been trying to get off the ground for years. So mm-hmm. it's cool to see some forward momentum on this.
Yeah, Remember when they made that Spawn cartoon like in the 90s? I loved early it. 90s.
It's all on HBO Max. Wasn't Sam and Twitch right in
that? Huh? Is it? Oh my god, I didn't need to rewatch
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. I have not rewatched it, so take that with a grain of salt as as I'm saying, like, I loved it watching it at 12 years old.
For sure, yeah. There's a lot of stuff like that.
Sure.
Like Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark is coming out. Or it came out, what, 40-something years ago?
40 years ago today, yeah, as we're recording this.
Yeah, that's crazy. Although those movies rule.
They slap, yeah.
But no, I can't remember if Sam and Twitch were in that cartoon, too. They must have made an appearance.
They did. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I believe they were supposed to be, like, leading characters in the new live-action yes. movie. Because, like, McFarlane's whole deal was that it was going to be a detective story with Spawn just kind of, like, in the shadows and in the background of the movie, which is a very Played by Jamie Foxx, yeah. Which is, like, to me, I still want to see what that movie's like, because you don't cast an actor that huge to, like, not be on screen. So I'm curious, like, how much, like, what the draw was there. It's a project that baffles and intrigues me every time it comes up in an interview.
Totally, for sure. One last point I think I forgot to make. Mayor of Easttown is the last show this production company made.
Oh, yeah. So it's, like, prestigious, too.
Yeah, and I mean, they're on a good run, mm-hmm. so maybe that's better news for this to actually happen as opposed to the past where it kind of just fizzled out.
For sure.
Other movie comics news. God Country is getting a film adaptation written by Johnny Cates, and it's coming from Aftershock Media and Legendary. I did not say that wrong, because God Country was an Image Comics book, yeah. but it's coming out from Aftershock, which is kind of funny.
Interesting.
I suppose because, you know, if you read an Image comic book, you own it, you can take it anywhere you like.
That's true.
It's not like Image has its own production company either.
Right, right. Yeah, this is cool. Yeah. It's cool to see, like, the Cates, like, having such an ownership over the adaptation as well.
I still remember, I think it was probably like 2 years ago, he was talking about how he was scripting this.
Mm-hmm.
So, gosh, it's whenever you, like, look into, like, movies, it's like, oh no, it didn't just take 2 years to make this. It actually took 15 years of someone grinding and scripting sure. and whatever. It's kind of amazing.
Improving the concept, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In other news, this actually could have been the biggest news of the week. The 2021 Eisner Award nominations were announced earlier this week.
Yeah.
Some big winners included Image Comics and Fantagraphics, as well as Gene Lone Yang. They all came away with the most nominations. Mm-hmm. If this was a race, they would all already have won.
Yeah, but also, speaking of race, this has been a conversation that's kind of dominated Twitter over the last few days, and I fully agree with it. It's a very white male, you know, predominantly. I mean, there are some real, it's really nice to see some representation in the nominees, but, like, I feel like comics is having its own Oscars so white kind of thing right now, where it's a downer. You know, you look at the top categories and so few, I think, what, the only woman nominated in, like, some of the top categories is Peach Momoko, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right.
And it's just, yeah, it's very... Best cover artist. It's frustrating.
It is. And if you read as many comics as we do, you know that this is kind of weird.
Yeah. And not to take anything away from people, you know, like Jeff Lemire and James Tynion and Chip Zdarsky, who are doing exceptional work, but it's just like, shit, I'd love to see, like, I'd love to see some more representation there.
No, totally. The next up, there was actually, so after Gene Lone Yang, there were a bunch of creators that had tied for the second most nominations, and they were all mostly white people. Ed Brubaker, Matt Fraction, Jeff Lemire, James Tynion, Chip Zdarsky.
Yeah.
Oh, what did Chip Zdarsky tweet?
Oh, Chip Zdarsky, let me get the actual wording, because it was very good. Hang on.
I definitely saw some creators pretty upset with the fact that there weren't more women nominated. One creator even said they weren't going to vote in the Eisners because of it. I won't name names just because, but
Twitter is frozen, so I guess I can't.
I feel like last year there were more females nominated, And it seemed like they were going in the right direction, because it was definitely a problem the year before that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's weird. It's also strange. Like, just Eisner's in general, like the people who are making these nominations, they always seem to be, not that they're not worthy of making nominations, but they always seem to be kind of random and randomly chosen, like from industries or aspects of the comics industry that you're not necessarily aware of. Like,
right.
Maybe comic shop owners or people in academia, stuff like that. And it always changes too.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, the judging panel will be a guy from a comic book shop. Let's see, a creator for the Power Knights, the Little Fish Comic Book Studio, another creator, comic book historians, Jim Thompson. I don't know.
Yeah, it's I mean, there's some great talent that's being recognized, but it does feel like there's still a long way to go.
Right, for sure. But we will probably be, well, no, we will be talking about this when the news comes out that the who the winners are, which mm-hmm. is going to be in July when San Diego Comic-Con does their virtual conference.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to our next bit of news. There's a new company similar to Kickstarter called Zoop. Coming out, the Comics Beat did a story on them, but we also ran an interview with the very first Zoop comic, Slow City Blues, which is launching from the app earlier this week. But so Zoop is a little different from Kickstarter. First of all, it has a funny name, but second of all,
it's a great name.
They don't just supply you the opportunity for people to bid and put money on this book so that it will be created and make the funds to be created, but they also market the book and help you with that aspect too,
which is huge.
Which is yeah totally. Like, we just had a Declan Chavy on, and he was going through Kickstarter, as one does, and I think he said right on the show, like, he's not necessarily done this before. He hasn't done the marketing aspect of it. It's new to him.
When we were talking to Jeff Smith a little while back, he was talking about how he's been in the business for, you know, 30 something years, and he's doing his first ever Kickstarter and is literally just like, I wasn't prepared for any of it. Like, not to, like, you know, take away from the work that he did, but he legitimately, if you listen to the interview, he said something along the lines of like, as soon as we were funded, I was like, oh, okay, so stretch goals, that's a thing? Like, it's stuff that you don't, like, think about if you haven't done it before and you're not sure what the response is going to be.
Right, totally. Yeah, there's a whole thing to be prepared for and set up for.
Yeah.
Just in case. Not to mention, like, just the sheer amount of work to market this stuff on Twitter and the interviews going and stuff, like, that's a job in itself. So I'm really curious to see how many folks use Zoop. I know I'm sure there are a lot of folks who, you know, like Elsa Chaturi, she's been on the show too twice, and like she's been on the show twice, and I think she's mastered the Kickstarter. Like, she knows how to market, do videos, do tweets, do interviews, et cetera, and, like, get the machine going. It's also about, like, timing.
But even when we were talking to her, she was saying that that's, like, a second full-time job. Like, she's like, it's a lot to do. So having a service like this sounds like a dream for people who want to stay indie.
I am curious, too, like, how... Is it a better deal for folks too, right? Like, how much of the cut does Zoop get versus Kickstarter?
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's interesting.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how many people use it going forward.
Mm-hmm.
In other news, Heavy Metal announces a new horror one-shot called Intrusion. It's out September 22nd. This is interesting. It's got Ethan Sachs writing, who's all over the place. He's done Star Wars books. He's done lots of Marvel stuff, along with Marco Lorenzana on art. Nice. I'm all for more horror, and the cool thing is this is a one-shot, so it's a low buy-in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it looks gorgeous. I mean, like, we've been talking recently a lot about how it feels like horror is having, like, a real heyday right now in comics, and I'm totally here for it.
Totally, yeah. It's also, like, a historical piece, too, which is cool.
Yeah, for sure.
And our last bit of news, Bill Willingham's Fables, which hasn't been around for over a decade, I think, is returning.
Like
out of nowhere, I don't think anyone saw this coming. No. Because I remember when Fables ended and like DC, everybody was just like, it's over. This is it. Yeah. Final thing. Of course, that's never true in comics, apparently. But yeah, in 2022, Fables will return to continue its series, actually with issue, what is it, 151.
Yeah.
And then also, but before that, if you were into Fables, there's going to be a Batman versus Bigby one-shot. Sure. I don't know. It's actually a series, a mini-series, kicking off in September, which, again, I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Why is this coming out now? This is so weird.
This whole thing is baffling. I mean, yeah, Fables is one of those books that I feel like I'm going to make this very brief because I don't want to be, like, just a downer on this episode.
Yeah.
But like no. Fables is one of those books that started off, I think, really strong and then just kind of really fizzled out and also became, unfortunately, way more about the author's particular politics than about the storytelling. And then, you know, in the time since then, Willingham has kind of not been super kind to people in the comics industry or people, like readers in general. Like he did this whole thing, you know, where he talked about how he had no interest or care for superhero books anymore and that he didn't want any part of it. And so
yeah,
seeing this big comeback rolling out with a Batman crossover just feels weird and calculated. And yeah, this was news that like confused me, but also I'm just like, okay, whatever.
Right.
The people who are excited about this, I'm happy for you, I guess.
I mean, I did see on Twitter, people were quote tweeting the news we posted and they were like, yes, if you want me to get back into this, Bigby versus Batman is the way. And
how is that? Sorry, you can cut that. I'm sorry.
Well, I guess from a marketing tactical standpoint, it's smart in that if you don't know who Bigby is, this book will probably draw you in.
That's
with
true.
Batman.
I mean, and again, but I'm the idiot who, like, a couple of weeks ago was just like, Snake Eyes is going to fight Batman. Like, so.
True.
Who knows?
True.
Like, maybe I'm just a hypocrite.
I don't know, though, because, like, honestly, like, I know that, you know, Fables lost a lot of audience along the way just because it was so long and long in the tooth. And I've seen multiple people say, like, gosh, the book just never ended. But
yeah, it got it drew its own story out, and then also just it went from being like a metaphor to being just like there was no subtext anymore. It just became text and was just hitting you over the head with messages that aren't that great. So it's one of those books that I never finished, so I can't imagine myself grabbing issue 151.
No, totally. And I mean, is the audience still there? They haven't read this book in so long. I don't know. It seems maybe like Bill Willingham like was just like, hey, I want to come back. And someone was like, oh, cool. We can maybe market this and sell it. But it'll be very interesting to see if this even sells that well. Maybe they're just bringing it back so they can do it one more trade, right? And then they can do some omnibus, like something that we forget is like there's a mechanician here where, you know, in this business where I've seen it with Marvel, like if we put out this these two one shots, we can then repackage that into this last arc that was only three issues, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, so and in my head, I'm like, okay, so when is the movie getting announced? You know what I mean? Like,
because this
feels like, I mean, this would have been a decision made, you know, during the AT&T days. So, like, it'll be interesting to see where this leads to, for sure.
Hell, I mean, our Tom McFarlane news totally feels a bit like, oh, Spawn Universe? Oh, and look at that, a Sam and Twitch show on the way.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, that's it for news. In our next segment, Top Books of the Week, we talk about our top two favorite books of the week. The books you must read.
And they truly are our top two books of the week. This was unprecedented.
I think this has only happened like twice.
Yeah.
We both picked our both number one and number two in the same rank as well.
Yeah.
Both of our second favorite book of the week was Spider-Man The Spider's Shadow, number 3, by Chip Zdarsky and Pasquale Ferry.
Yeah.
This, if you don't know, is a what-if. It is literally in the what-if universe or line for a Spider-Man story where Spider-Man never got the symbiote removed from him from the Fantastic Four. Instead, he kept it. And oh no, Peter, don't do that because that's going to make you a real bad person.
The first thing he does is kill the Hobgoblin.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal in that first issue. Yeah. And this issue really leans into the horror element of Spider-Man as basically Venom, as the symbiote wearing monstrosity. And he's letting that symbiote get to him because we know Peter's still in there. And I'm sure Chip will pull that up, peel that off, and show us that, that he's still a good person deep down. But he's letting the symbiote influence him and make him do bad things.
Yeah, this like this was the first issue of the series where this like really clicked for me, because I felt like issue one was like a lot of setup and stuff and like beats we've seen before. Issue two was like more setup just from like the villain's point of view. And then this one, I think, really cranks it up. Like you said, this this issue feels like a slasher film where Spider-Man is Jason Voorhees. Like, and the camp counselors are the Sinister Six. Like, this issue is just Spider-Man cleaning house. And but it also has, like, the characterization of J. Jonah Jameson in this is really fantastic. It starts to peel back those layers and show you that, like, Pete's like defeated here. It also has a really great setup for what the rest of this miniseries is going to be. Like the final page is terrifying.
It's interesting, you know, knowing that Chip Zdarsky, it's his story that made J. Jonah Jameson a good guy in the main storyline.
Sure.
Well, he was always a good guy, but he was on Peter's side, right? And you can see that here, but he's still smart enough to go, okay, wait, Jameson actually tried to kill Peter once, or Spider-Man, with the Spider Slayers.
Yeah.
So he's still...
And he bankrolled the Scorpion, so like he's still an asshole at this point.
But he's kind of connecting those two dots, so that it still feels true to the character, but it's also updating him for the newer version of Jameson, because you can see Jameson does feel for Peter when, spoilers, he finds out Peter is Spider-Man.
Right.
What got me on this issue was like... The villains, our Sinister Six, are like actually the victims, and they kind of have a point. Like, we need to get rid of Spider-Man because he's gonna kill us.
The issue opens with like, because it was funny because at this point you've seen Spider-Man kill like three people or something like that. Like he killed Hobgoblin, and he killed Scorpion last issue, and Kingpin, and Shocker, and then this issue opens up with like. A montage of like there 17 people are dead. Like he's got the Beatles body in his back seat. Like there's just like he's been on a killing spree. And so it kind of repositions this episode into a sort of like Lethal Foes of Spider-Man kind of story.
Right, sure. And Spider-Man is so haunting in this book. Yes. He is like this alien entity that is
mandible
to be feared.
Kind of design on the mouth is so effective,
right? So inhuman.
Yeah,
very cool book. Totally check it out.
Absolutely.
And for our favorite book of the week, we both chose The Good Asian Number 2 by Pornsack Pitchashote and Lee Lothridge.
So we
had Pornsack on the show months ago now, but you know, I guess it's worth saying we got to read this issue months ago too, but we got to reread it again.
Yeah.
So just a testament to this book, how good it is.
Yeah. I was still blown away by it.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you don't know, Nathan and I are big noir fans and this book, it does it in an effective way, but also with color. It's doing it in a really cool modern sort of way. Yeah. And the detective story here is nuanced and detailed, and it just draws you in.
And it does, like, we talked about this a little bit during the interview, but it does such interesting things with flashbacks. Like, sometimes you'll see a character get introduced to Edison, the lead character, and, like, as a side panel, it'll show you him remembering something about them. Like, there's a really, like, that, there's a heartbreaking moment where he remembers someone saying like, "You're just trash that my father brought home," or something like that. Like, and it's but it's done in like a kind of fuzzier sepia kind of look to it, so it's visually distinct from the rest of the book. The visual storytelling in this is incredible, because like noir is such a hard, I think noir is really difficult to fully capture on the comics page. Because sometimes you can have it just be too much narration, or or not enough exposition, or, you know, it's a very delicate balance. And I think that this feels like, if this isn't made into like a television series within the next couple of years, like, what are we, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it feels cinematic to me.
Oh, totally. It really does. And how many issues is it again? It's like 10 issues, I think. I believe it's supposed to be planned. Yeah. Alexandra Tefenki is the artist, right? And then Lee Lufferge is the colorist.
Mm-hmm.
Together, they're doing really interesting work as far as, you know, film noir. But also, like, I think we both said this when it came to the first issue when we talked to Pornsack. Like, the world feels so well rendered. Not only the environments, but the people in the background, and it feels lived in. And I think that's an element of detective stories that's really important.
For sure.
Like, that detective lives in this other world that, you know, we can only begin to imagine, because, you know, usually these kind of stories, it's like a seedy underworld where there's bad guys and stuff. But also, like, you know, it's usually taking place in a different time and place, as this story is. And I think that's pretty difficult to capture quickly. And the art team is just doing a great job with that.
Oh, yeah. And the thing about Edison is that he's... nobody trusts him. Either the white guys on the force don't trust him because he's Asian, or the people he's investigating don't believe that he's a police officer. Like, he is literally a man without a country. Like, and it's so interesting seeing him navigating, and heartbreaking to see him navigating the kind of prejudices that he has to face just to do his job, a job that he hates doing.
Right. Yeah, which is just another nuance to the story that's just so smart.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so check that book out. I wouldn't be surprised if it is a TV show eventually. So yeah, buy all the comics so that you can sell them for $400.
Right, buy later. Two of them so you can keep one of them.
There you go, yeah, then resell it. In our next segment, standout...
Kapow!
Moment of the week.
Yeah, I was a little late on that one.
That's all right. This is our segment where we talk about our favorite moment or the most splashy moment, if that, from the week's comics. What was your favorite Kapow moment?
Man, so I really enjoyed the DC Pride number one special. Like, there were so many great little vignettes in that story or in that issue. Dave actually texted me in the middle of the week just to say, like, hey, you've got to read this because there's like the best John Constantine pinup, which rules. But my favorite moment, something I've been thinking about all week, is, and I sent it to you in the chat, Midnighter uppercuts a Nazi vampire so hard that he explodes.
Didn't even know that was possible.
It's so good. It's this... this great story with Midnighter. It's by Steve Orlando and Stephen Byrne. Midnighter and Extraño are going into this vampire's lair because he's going to cast a spell that will rewrite history to remove important queer figures from history. It's this wild high concept story, and of course it ends with Midnighter basically just like curb stomping a Nazi. So it's everything you want in one in one like 6-page story. But yeah, that moment just made me happy, like seeing him just he says he's gonna bite him, and then he goes, "Don't tease me," and Midnighter uppercuts him and his head falls off.
That's so awesome. Yeah. I wish there was like an ongoing Midnighter series.
Oh my god. I mean, the backups in Action Comics with Michael Conrad, Becky Cloonan, and Michael Oeming are great. But it makes you wish that there was like a full book every month.
Yeah, he had his heyday. God, what was it? Was it late 90s? Probably, right? When Authority came out?
I mean, I personally adore... I loved Steve Orlando's Midnighter series and the Midnighter and Apollo miniseries. Those were both, I think, exceptional. And honestly, anytime Steve Orlando gets to write this character, it makes me really happy.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's like coming home.
Yeah, absolutely.
My favorite Kapow moment was from Spider-Man, Spider's Shadow number 3.
Never heard of it.
So there's a couple of really great single moments I could have pulled from, but the one that really struck me, there's a moment where Spider-Man has yet to strike on his ultimate villains, and he's up in the trees on a web.
Oh, man.
The darkness.
Yes.
And someone says something like, okay, just remember, it doesn't really matter what they say in this, because it's just so haunting the way he's sort of like positioned himself to like spring out. And instead of just like going in, talking to them, or like just rushing in, instead he's decided to make a full web up in the trees in the darkness and just sit there and look down at them like they're prey. Like, it's such a cool moment.
It literally is like a predator scene. Like, it's terrifying. Like, the moment that everyone, and it's one of those things where they're like trying to plan what they're going to do, and then he's there and he's ready.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was what I was expecting from the series, and to kind of get that payoff in this third issue is really great.
For sure.
In our next segment, Top Books for Next Week, we're going to talk about our most anticipated comic out next week.
Yeah.
I'm picking Demon Days Mariko by Peach Momoko. This is the second issue in the Demon Days run. And first of all, Momoko is writing and drawing. So first of all, it's beautiful, beautiful book.
Absolutely.
It's going to be. Anyway, and it's really neat, this idea. It's taking characters we know and sort of molding them into a different story from a different time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like Elseworlds tales, you'll like this probably.
Yeah.
It's incredibly unique and just a take you wouldn't expect. And this one, I don't want to spoil it because I haven't been able to look at it a little early, but it has Akira vibes here and there.
Which is really sweet.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm in.
The painterly quality is so cool when done well in comics.
Yeah, Momoko's artwork is incredible. Like I think I've sung her praises a few times in like very recent episodes too.
Oh yeah. What is your most anticipated book of next week?
I'm really looking forward to Ultra Mega number 4 by James Herron and Dave Stewart. This series just keeps changing on me in a way that's fucking thrilling. Like, it's so bizarre. The first issue was like high concept body horror mixed with kaiju action. The second issue is like a Mad Max end of the world on the run kind of feel. The third issue is like gladiatorial combat mixed with weird political satire. So like what's next? Like, the last issue, spoiler alert, basically ends with like the lead character bleeding out. So I don't even know. Like, at this point, I'm like, sure, maybe the next issue will start with a new lead character. Like, there's just, I don't even know what to expect from it. And that's why it continues to be one of my favorite books on the shelf.
Yeah, that's kind of the beauty of these creator-owned books, especially like Image. Like, anything can go, right?
Yeah, and every issue of Ultra Mega is supersized. So it's just, man, there's so much.
Nice package, great art.
It's the end of the first story arc, too, so I'm expecting, like, things to get weirder than usual.
Right, fireworks. That's a cool pick. In our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, we're going to talk about our most favoritist art out next week.
Uh-huh.
I had a really hard time with this one.
Yeah, I kept going back and forth on a couple as well.
What was your favorite cover art out next week?
My favorite is Legends of the Dark Knight number 2, Riley Rossmo variant cover. First of all, I love any time that we get like bright color palette on a Batman cover. I also feel like I pick Batman covers a lot, but I'm sorry, as long as Batman is cool, I'll keep doing it. But Rossmo has been drawing some killer Batman stuff over in the Harley Quinn solo series right now. And it's just really cool to see this design on the front cover of a book. But he's facing off with the Riddler. It's got this kind of pop art feel to it. But my absolute favorite thing is that Batman is in the foreground and there's a word balloon coming up from his head that just has a question mark. And you see Riddler way in the background and his word balloon is a bat. And I think that's adorable. And
that is funny.
Just really, really clever use of the medium. Also, weird little things, like I love how the cape is spread out. I love the bright, like he has a brightly colored batarang. I don't know why I like that so much.
Oh yeah, the batarang isn't usually yellow like
right.
that.
Right, it's just, it's a really stylish and cool looking cover, but the word balloons like seal the deal for me.
Yeah, and then someone's holding some sort of weapon, I think, and Batman's looking at him, right? Off panel.
Yeah, there's some kind of... Yeah, it's weird because it would seem to be someone, like the Riddler standing in front of him with his cane, but the Riddler's way back there. So, yeah, it's very odd.
Oh my god, or, intrigue!
Or like Batman's running through like a bunch of like blades. Very cool... it almost looks like it would be a death trap in the 1960s Batman series.
Yeah, you're totally right. Yeah, like it's got this kind of like almost goopiness to it.
Yeah.
My favorite cover art, I had two picks, but I have to reduce it to one. There are two variants from Venom number 200 out next week that I really love, but I'm going to go with Arthur Adams' cover.
Hell yeah.
Actually, he posted progress shots of this like a month ago. On his Instagram, and it was so cool to see like the pencils and the inks and then finally the color. Yeah. And it's interesting when artists, especially someone who's been working for so long like Arthur Adams, sort of throw their interpretation on a character. And Venom is one where his head and the way he has a tongue and teeth can be so different depending on the artist.
I love the jowls on this one.
Yeah, he's got like this weird neck. It's almost like he's like a neck pouch or something.
Yeah, it's reptilian for sure.
Oh yeah. And his head is so tiny compared to his body. Oh yes. By the way, if you go to aptcomics.com and go to this podcast post, you can see the full cover for yourself. But he's just so hulking and huge. Yeah. I think that always worked for me as far as Venom.
I know, for sure.
Todd McFarlane's first design, he was pretty much just a dude in a suit, but people have just made him more and more muscular and huge, and here he's just so big. But he's sort of stepping over the title of Venom as he's coming towards us, directly towards us. And so he's rendered really cool and huge and big. He's got this super long tongue, which draws your eye right down the middle to the Venom title at the bottom.
Yeah.
Which is then like wrapped in webs in between each letter. It's really cool, stylized. This is clearly hand-drawn Venom written out by Arthur Adams. Then, on the face of the Venom, you've got the red of, like, blood, but there's, like, goo coming up from underneath the cover.
And to top it all off, he's, like, staring into something's jaws.
Right, yeah, so from our perspective, there's actually teeth framing the entire cover, which is just another layer to it all.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really, really cool.
They put it up for sale and I was like, oh, maybe I can put bid for it. I think it went for like $12,000 or something insane. Yeah. 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 That's what you get I was looking at Andy Kubert art cause I was like, oh, his detective.
I was just looking at it recently too. Actually.
Man, what is he like 4,000 a page or something like
that? Yeah. I mean, well-deserved. They're so good.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He's earned it. He's earned it for sure. Well, that's it for Judging by the Cover Junior. In our next segment, join us as we talk to Dan Fogler about his times at Heavy Metal and writing over there. It's going to be really cool. And on with us is Dan Fogler. Dan, you are doing so much great work at Heavy Metal. Thank you so much for being on the AAPT Comics podcast.
Thanks for having me. This is delightful.
So it's been a year. Well, more than a year at this point, I suppose. Can you tell us a little bit about... I know that you've done other interviews before and you've gone to conventions that's actually how you met Heavy Metal, going to conventions. How has your relationship to comics and the creation of comics changed in the last year?
Wow, my relationship to comics and the creation of comics. Well, I'm very proud of Fish Kill. Mm-hmm. My relationship to comics right now is like a proud father, because I have three of my children out there. I got Fish Kill, I got Moon Lake, and I have Brooklyn Gladiator coming out. And let me talk about it like this, because Moon Lake was the first child, and that was the really the homage to Heavy Metal and Heavy Metal the movie and Tales from the Crypt and Twilight Zone. And like you said, I was over at a signing at Arkea Black Label, who first put it out. And I was at, San Diego one year when it first came out, and I was signing it. And I said, and in the foreword, it says this is an homage to, Heavy Metal and Heavy Metal the movie. And I said, you know what, let me go over and just give a book over to the guys at the Heavy Metal booth. And I did. and they said, "We like you." And and so
you got Moxie.
You got Moxie, kid. And so even if I didn't have a book or mm-hmm. Or a book with them that I was pushing, they would always let me, squat at their table basically.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. For years, man. And all my work is really derivative of that one, first moment where I picked Heavy Metal was the first comic book I picked up, which is crazy.
Wow.
I was 10 years old and I was way too young. And then I saw the movie and then that was it. I was like, everything's come full circle basically for me.
Yeah.
And Fishkill for me is something special because it's like nothing I've tried before. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm very proud of it.
Yeah. And the first trade paperback just came out in May, I think. And there's more to come, right?
Yeah. We have volume one mm-hmm. Is out now with Simon Schuster is putting that out and which is very exciting. And we have volume two is in the works.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. And Ben Templesmith is working on the art and I've been a fan of his since 30 Days a Night.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So it was just a miracle to have him working on the book and to have four issues, completed
yeah.
and like in a trade is very, I'm still pinching myself about that.
Like it exists. I'm holding it.
Exactly. Yeah. I can smell it,
Yeah, there's a Heavy Metal label on it.
I mean,
that's wild.
And Simon Beasley, who I also love his art, from Lobo, and he also did Heavy Metal covers back in the day. He did Brooklyn Gladiator, and so I'm just in a space with comic books where I'm just like I'm living the dream. Yeah.
Well, like we touched on it already. You worked with some incredible artists. You said Simon Bisley, Ben Templesmith, Derek Robertson. I mean, like, what's your working relationship like with these artists? How's that collaboration go?
Oh my God. They're like buddies. They're like my buddies.
That's great. That's the dream.
You be a fan and then be the buddy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think that they really appreciate that their work has influenced me and I let them know it,
Yeah.
I'm not shy about it. And I think they, I'm just genuine in my appreciation of them. And they people appreciate that. And I also know that I'm dealing with people who are, volatile rock and roll artists.
Sure.
You have to let them have their space and you have to, it's rock and roll, man. The art comes out of, letting them do their thing. So it's, I think they appreciate working with me. I'm not really a harsh critic.
Right on.
Are you guys going back and forth, like working on panels, or do you hand them a script and they kind of run with it?
Exactly. Cause I put as much detail as I can without going overboard
mm-hmm.
In the scripts. And then I say, and I always put like, asterisks, but you're a genius. So put your mark on it.
Sure, I mean?
Like,
sure.
So they always put their mark on it and you hope that it's, the alchemy,
mm-hmm.
Rises above the page, and I feel like it happens, in Brooklyn Gladiator, and especially in Fishkill, the chemistry there, for me, I'm very excited about it. I would love to hear what you guys feel about it.
Man, there's so much cool, like you were saying, there's so much visual world building in Fishkill and in Brooklyn Gladiator. Like there's so much stuff that's communicated through newspaper clippings or montages or changes in like little things like changes in what color the narration boxes are in, kind of changes how a scene feels, in terms of like tone. I mean, that was actually something I wanted to ask, is like, you're also a screenwriter and a director, you know, like how does that experience translate into like working on a comic script, like trying to create a mood and a tone? Because it feels like, I'm just kind of rambling at this point, in Fishkill, every single page, it feels like a bomb's about to go off, even before the bomb goes off.
Right.
Wow. That's a great compliment.
Oh,
I mean, I'll take it as a compliment.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Yeah. No,
it does. There's like this mounting tension that doesn't great. Like it. You're just uncomfortable the whole time in a, like a cool way, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, Fishkill is, you know, I equate it to, it's like The Fugitive. It's like, Chinatown, you know,
sure.
It's like, it's the seeds. It's the prequel for Brooklyn Gladiators. So
yeah,
you see the, sci-fi element being sprinkled in.
Right.
So when writing a script, whenever I do dialogue or coming from an actor's perspective, I do all the characters, I do all the voices, and I tape it. I tape myself.
I was actually going to ask about that. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And you know, everything may not end up on the page, but you find like real gems in there, you know, really, you know, real lines, because it real, or, you know, dialogue that's, feels like it's different or it's improv, because it is, you know, it's,
yeah.
it came out of, an improv with myself, you know,
and yeah, characters also, will interrupt themselves sometimes, yes. which is yeah, kind of cool. True. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially characters, like, MJ, who is this homeless man who has many, many personalities, also seems as if he's a prophet, and he has all the different color, word balloons. And sometimes he's speaking in hip hop. Sometimes he's speaking in Shakespeare, you know, sometimes he's like this, you know, street prophet. Yeah, it's really fun to improvise that, you know, with yourself. You sound like a maniac. You sound like a lunatic. But I also have my writing partner is Lawrence Blum.
Yeah.
And he is also an actor. And he has, we gravitated towards this project because he's constantly playing cops and detectives, and it's like he just has done endless research in the the procedural, you know, kind of work that goes into all this, and so he was a great source for that. We improvised together, and it's a fun process. I do a lot of recording. That's what, you know, and I do that when I'm learning my lines. I record, like if I'm doing a movie or a TV show, and I have to memorize my lines, you know, fairly quickly, I record the entire script, and I play everybody's character, and I listen to it over and over again, because I come from theater, and I need that rehearsal where you hear everybody. So that's my rehearsal, you know, like I do my own rehearsal.
Is it the same when you're writing screenplays? Is it the same kind of process?
Absolutely, exactly the same. Doing dialogue, I tape everything, and I work out the scenes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very excited about Brooklyn Gladiator, man. It's gonna be a fucking movie.
Right.
Yeah, we're shooting it in October.
Oh, I didn't know you had a start date on that.
Yeah, I know the trade's coming out July 20th, I think.
Yes, and we're starting to shoot the film, and that's all I'm going to say. I'm very excited. Okay. I'm very excited. Yeah, I mean,
that's so cool. Yeah, that's, I mean, from Kickstarter to Hollywood.
Yeah, man. You know, that's always the Kickstarter is interesting. Going down that path, and I got on that boat during that time. But it's, you know, wherever it came from, it has since blossomed into what I wanted it to be. It's become. You know, all of my books, I hope that they're going to spin off into, like, we're Moon Lake, we're working on an animated show.
Oh, that's perfect. Like an anthology series?
Yes, sir.
Oh, but that's cool.
An anthology series with the through line of the narrator. And of course, you have different characters.
Yeah.
Popping up and teaming up, you know, as the series goes along. It's kind of like because anyone could do an anthology, but Moon Lake is, I got a hint from Heavy Metal, the movie, where the Lochnar through everything. And I thought, shit, I want to do that.
You know? Sure.
So my Lochnar is the man in the moon, and he weaves all the stories together. And then it's kind of like each season it's an anthology that kind of unravels, you know, and the barriers come down and the characters start mingling with each other.
Nice. That's cool though. Cause like, I feel like I love, I mean, I've actually talked about this on the show a lot. I love anthologies cause there tends to be like a little less of a buy-in, you know, like you can drop into an episode or an issue here and there, but having something that kind of culminates like that, especially for a series, is really cool.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's been done before, and I'd love to try it. And I love Death and Robots. You know,
oh gosh,
yeah.
Season 2
just started.
I watched it so quickly that I forgot that I watched it like a month later.
Yeah. Just power through it. Yeah, but it's so good.
It's pretty genius.
You know? It is. It's so beautiful. There's so much to it. It's so nuanced, but. Yeah, the anthology element is so exciting, right? Because you can tell so many different types of stories.
Yeah, not like imagine if characters, you know, in the next season of, or how many seasons are there? Like, let's say in the next season they start to
I think they're on 2.
They start to interact with each other. You know, they start to
pop, or they bring back something from the year before. Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? I mean, that's kind of like what I'm trying to cultivate.
Yeah, for sure.
So you basically pitched Heavy Metal, the book you already had written, but when you're writing, knowing that Heavy Metal is going to publish your work, do you feel this need to go harder, go edgier? Because I feel like Heavy Metal, it's like a church of comics. You know, you've got Marvel Comics, you've got these superheroes, and they get edgy sometimes, but Heavy Metal, it like goes hard. Was there this maybe pressure to go hard with your stories?
Fuck, I can't help but go hard. You know? You know, that's how I roll, man. Like, Tarantino style. But so that's why Heavy Metal is really the perfect place. What happened? See, I try to do what hasn't been done before. I try to push the envelopes.
Sure.
You know, and so you have to break some rules. And that's why they had me at Arkea Black Label. And then that's why when Boom swallowed up Arkea, they didn't know what the fuck to do with me. You know, sure. They were like, you're a little too risky for us. So then I was floating around forever. And then, so thank God I ended up at Heavy Metal, which is like, you know, like
meeting of the minds there. Yeah.
Full circle, kismet, perfect. You know?
Awesome. Well, when you were working on, you talked about this a little bit earlier, but when you were working with Temple Smith on Fishkill, is there like a moment, like in one of those moments where you said, you know, but you're a genius, do your thing. Mm. When you got the final product that just blew you away, like something you didn't even expect?
From the moment he started working on it and the pages started coming in, Larry and I were just in shock. You know, we were just like, oh my God, it's happening, and it's happening.
Sure.
It's happening quickly. And because the whole project came together in a very short amount of time.
Oh yeah.
And so as the pages came in, it was just like, okay, that's perfect. You know, okay, that's exactly what we wanted.
Awesome.
Because I'm a fan of his work, I just knew he, and because the pages were coming in a timely manner, I knew he was digging it. And he kept on saying, like, I really like these characters. I really dig the script. Listen, you know, here's a guy that needs to be inspired. And so when the pages were coming in, what was really beautiful was like seeing like, oh my God, this is working. It's like you're, you know, it's taking shape, and you know, I don't want to pat myself on the back, but you have a vision, and for me, who does, you know, werebears and, you know, zombie dinosaurs, and who does, you know, over the top sci-fi dystopian cage matches, this was something that was like, whoa, this is a little more sophisticated. This is a little, you know, a little classier, and we're pulling it off, and it's working. And you know, heavy metal is like, wow, this is, you know, one of the best titles we have. And so it was just it was, the validation was huge, because as an actor, you come into this and you're just like, all right, prove it, actor boy.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And then we got two actors, you know, me and Larry, you know, and we just, we were just like, all right, let's do our best here. And
yeah.
You know,
well,
Temple Smith just, for me, he knocked it out of the park.
That's great. I mean, that's the thing, is like, even, I mean, film and do it in theater can go the same way. You can have, you know, a really strong script and still not know what the final product's going to be like. So I'm sure there's like this moment of like, hell yeah, we're actually making this thing that we wanted to make.
Yeah, there's so much. I say that all the time. Like, it's a ship's journey, you know?
Yeah.
All of these adventures, you know, film, you can have the greatest cast and the greatest director, and you can go out and you could, you know, bring back fucking gold.
Yeah.
And still the ship sinks, you know, you're just like,
or you make something great and no one sees it. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and so there's, it's like, that's why this business is so magical. It's like going to Vegas. It's like going to Vegas in that sense, where so many moons have to line up in order for you to have a hit.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take off, you know, enough of those boxes, you can really satisfy yourself in this business.
For sure.
Fishkill blends so much too. Like, it blends crime. You've got the filth of the city, drug use, corruption. With all of those things combined, I mean, I was almost getting like RoboCop vibes at times, like the filth of the city element. Did you have any inspirations in life or film or books or comics that you read when, you know, starting tackling this with Lawrence?
I was writing Brooklyn Gladiator, mm-hmm. which is, you know, basically Escape from New York, Matrix, Blade Runner, you know, Mad Max.
Mad Max in there for sure.
Yeah. And as I was writing it, and as the world was starting to go to hell.
Yeah, sure.
I realized, whoa, we're living the sci-fi dystopia right now.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm going to write the prequel. And so I said, okay, what's the catalyst that sets the, you know, that lights the wick that is the bomb of Brooklyn Gladiator? So in this, what are my influences? My influences are, I said in the Brooklyn Gladiator universe that all conspiracies are true. They all, every one of them exists. And so I started just dabbling with that. And over the course of Brooklyn Gladiator, I will touch on every single conspiracy out there if I can.
Nice.
And the same thing for Moon Lake, except that's a more, you know, broader, crazier version of that. But I'm fascinated with it. Ever since I was in New York, I was here in New York. I'm in Brooklyn right now, but I was in Manhattan 20 blocks away from 9/11 when it happened.
Okay? Wow.
So that shook me to the bone. And Ever since that day, I've kind of gone down rabbit hole after rabbit hole after rabbit hole. And so that is really the inspiration for a lot of the world of Brooklyn Gladiator.
Mm-hmm. Is how would people in power use this moment?
Well, you look at it is a mirror, a warped mirror reflection of what's happening to us today. There is a let's it's crazy how prescient Fishkill is, in the sense that we wrote this way before 2019. So what happens is, in Fishkill, it's insane how many correlations there are. But so there's Fishkill's a detective. He's put on a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
The Brooklyn Bridge, which is the site of a terrorist attack in the first issue, which is an homage to The Boys comic book.
Sure.
Because in that universe, the planes are diverted from the tower and it hits Brooklyn Gladiator. Well, that's funny. It's the Brooklyn Bridge. And it hits Brooklyn Gladiator.
The actual comic.
Yeah, it hits the comic. And it bounces off. No. A superhero diverts it from the Twin Towers and it hits the Brooklyn Bridge, and that's the big disaster. So I thought, yeah, I want to kind of have an alternate kind of universe as well in Fishkill. And so this disaster happens on the Brooklyn Bridge. And our hero, a police officer, a black police officer, becomes the patsy. He's blamed for it.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes the lone wolf bomber. And then he has to, like the fugitive, has to prove his innocence against the fucking the world, against the deep state, you know. So you have elements of, you know, cops being the bad guy and civil unrest,
right?
And, you know, and lockdowns and martial law and a mysterious flu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really weird reading this coming out of quarantine.
Dan, why did you do this to us?
I manifested this.
Right.
Stay off the Brooklyn Bridge. No, I'm just worry sometimes, you know, like who said that? Grant Morrison or something? Be careful what you write.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Yeah. Cause you may manifest some stuff. I worry about that. I'm just like, should I just give this a happy ending with rainbows?
Right.
You know, like
so sure, I know it works but, out.
You know, it's definitely if you look at Fishkill, it's definitely Lawrence and I tapped into something in the collective that was that was a warning, or you know, something. I don't know, man.
Yeah.
Or I just, it's a trip. You know, just through cognitive reasoning, just reverse engineering. How do we get from the world of Brooklyn Gladiator and reverse engineering that? You know.
Yeah.
And then. It's what's scary is that the whole thing is not far off from the headlines.
Sure.
Like you can imagine if we just keep on slipping down the slippery slope of just the technocracy taking over our lives, we can very much end up in that Brooklyn Gladiator 1984 realm where every aspect of our lives is under scrutiny. And we're just, you know, guinea pigs.
Oof.
Well.
Hey! <I know. laughs>
Way to bring the room up.
It's a cautionary tale. It's a caution.
Yeah, you gave me, like, I'm having, like, an existential crisis right now.
I mean,
you should be.
Dan's not wrong, I don't think. It's pretty scary out there.
Well, this was actually brings me to something Dave and I were talking about, is that, like, you know, Fishkill himself, he's put through the ringer in the story, and there's like a lot of like it. There is a darkness there. Like there's a lot of like unseemly characters and situations, and like how do you get into the headspace to just go into the darkness like that? Does it just kind of flow from wanting to explore these ideas? You're just like, okay, I guess I have to follow it.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone down some pretty dark research rabbit holes.
Sure.
You know, and I've seen enough. There's enough content out there. It's out there, man. I mean, yeah. you know, he goes deep into the, you know, he goes into the war, he goes into the remote viewing MK Ultra world.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you guys know what I'm talking about when I say that. Yeah.
Because I've had plenty of sleepless nights reading conspiracy theories on the internet. I mean, we all have computers in our hands all the time, and that's a boon and a curse.
The Manchurian Candidate, you know, that's you know, Sinatra was, they made a movie with Sinatra, and then they made the movie with Liev Schreiber, I think.
And Denzel.
And so that concept where you can have a remote control person, you know, is scary. And so that's what happens to Fishkill, except his programming starts to unravel.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that's an interesting character. You know, the monster, the Frankenstein that they create comes back to get them, you know? Mm-hmm. And so how do I, you know, I take from my favorite characters. Like, there's a character, Angus, in it.
Mm-hmm.
He's like a cousin of the Joker in a lot of ways, you know. you know, there's like Sebastian Caspian, who is like basically the main villain in it, except there's always someone higher on the totem pole that's giving them, you know, orders. He, you know, he's based on a lot of different political figures out there that I've found to be shady. You know, there's a lot of content on those people as well, how they talk, mannerisms. So we sprinkle all that in there, you know. We're living in a dark world. It's not hard to you know, draw from the well.
Yeah. I mean, you hit on an interesting point. Like, the, you know, the guy that you view as the big bad is really more middle management, you know, like there's always someone else pulling the strings, and it's always kind of scary to think about, you know, tracing it back, you know?
Yeah. Following the money. What's the real agenda?
Mm-hmm.
How deep does the rabbit hole go? And it's kind of like, is Fish, you know, Fishkill may take out one of these guys, but, you know, there's so many heads of the dragon, you know?
Right, right.
So going to this dark place, are you reading any comics right now to take you out of the dark place or go deeper into the dark place?
You know, I mean, I have my favorite comics. Mm-hmm. It has been, and I'm sad about it, it's been forever since I've actually been into a comic shop, unless I was dropping off my own comics there for them to sign and stuff.
Yeah.
I was an every Wednesday guy before I mean, I guess when I was in London, when things cooled off a little bit, I'd go to Forbidden Planet out there and I'd grab my comics. And at the time I was reading, I'll tell you what I was reading at the time. I was reading, I love it. So I was reading Moonshine because I love Eduardo Risso and whatever they do. And then I was reading, I got into the whole Deceased thing where, you know, zombie.
Yeah, Tom Taylor.
Superhero. I got into, East of West ended, and that was very sad for me. So you see how long ago I was. What's out now? What do you recommend I get into?
Well, one book that you would probably be into is called The Department of Truth.
Okay, great.
It's about conspiracy theories. It's about
like tulpas and people shaping history by creating big lies and then disseminating them among the people. It's a trip.
Every issue has a different conspiracy theory, and I guess the central conceit is if enough people believe in a conspiracy theory, it actually becomes real. And in the first issue, we see flat earthers are gaining traction. There's just enough of them, so the Earth actually physically turns flat, but it's stopped by the Department of Truth. Actually, it's they're making it a TV show or something right now as well.
Yeah. It's
amazing.
But it just started. Great. We're only like 8 issues into it or something.
Yeah.
What's the team? Who's
James Tynan is writing. He's also the main writer of Batman right now. And then Martin Simmons is the artist. He's known for Punk's Not Dead and a few other books.
Oh, okay.
IDW and stuff. You should totally, I think if this is your bag, I think you'd love it.
Yeah, for
that
sure.
That sounds fucking cool, actually.
I think it just got nominated for like 3 Eisners too.
Yeah,
really?
Like that. Yeah.
Nice.
And then the current Swamp Thing series is really fantastic too.
Yes. That's written by Ron B with Mike Perkins on art.
Yeah. That's one that that's the one I look forward to every month. Like when it comes into my inbox, I'm like, finally.
If you go to AIPTcomics.com, you can read reviews of all of those books.
We have an homage to the Swamp Thing in Moon Lake.
Oh yeah,
and he's the marijuana man.
Oh, that's funny. I haven't seen that.
That's great.
Yes, it's basically a complete ripoff of the Swamp Thing,
but just weed.
But he's made out of marijuana.
Bless him.
and the shrooms that grow off of him are psychedelic.
That's great.
Well, Dan, that's it for our interview portion, but in our last segment, off topic, top shelf, we want to ask you, what are you into right now that's not comic book related? What are you up to?
Oh, funky. What do I do that's not comic book related? I like mixed martial arts.
Oh, cool.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I like it's outside of comic books, but I like I'm making movies. I'm making a bunch of movies.
Yeah,
which is really fun.
Awesome.
I'm very excited. I'm going out to LA, for 6 months, and I'm going to be in this show called The Offer. And I'm playing Francis Ford Coppola.
No way.
No kidding. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Get out of town. Did you get to meet Francis and like mirror him?
That's about the making of The Godfather, right?
Yes, sir. And I'm trying to finagle a meeting through. I worked with his son, nephew, Robert Schwartzman. Uh-huh. So he says he can get me a meeting with his mother, Talia, and with Francis. So I'm trying to fucking
finagle that.
That's amazing. Yeah. Congratulations. That's so cool.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. That's something I'm just like, what? I can't believe it. You know, there's certain things that have happened in my life that are total out of the blue miracles. And this is another one of them. I'm totally grateful and just humbled by the whole freaking thing. It's amazing,
man. This is a stacked cast too. I was just I'm just looking up the other information on it. That's really great.
Yeah, I'm so excited to work with these guys.
Yeah,
yeah,
awesome, man.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for taking the time. Fish Kill, the trade paperback, is out now. Brooklyn Gladiators out July 20th. Moon Lake Volume 1 is out June 15th.
You guys are wonderful. Thank you.
Hey, appreciate that. We try to be wonderful. At the minimum, we want to be wonderful.
Okay, good. You achieved full wonderfulness.